Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Downing has served 22 years in jail for a crime he has always claimed he did not commit, and from his cell at Dorchester Prison praised the investigative campaign launched by the Matlock Mercury and supported this week by both Central Television and the Daily Star.
Stephen Downing was ordered to be detained at Her Majesty's pleasure after being convicted of the murder of Mrs. Wendy Saul at Nottingham Crown Court on February 15, 1974. Home Office reports describe him as a model prisoner, always polite, well-mannered and cooperative, mature and well-balanced, no danger to the public. So this was in
1995, January.
Stephen's been monitored constantly during his 22 years in prison and has constantly maintained his innocence, saying he admitted the offence originally to protect his sister. Last March, he was allowed a home visit to Bakewell to spend time with his parents and sister Christine under supervision and received a very warm welcome from friends, relatives and residents. The officer who travelled with him remarked on his unusual welcome in a Home Office report and stated, maybe there's something in the point he's trying to make about not being guilty.
I am innocent, he told the Mercury. I always said the truth will come out one day, but can't really understand why it has taken 22 years for the police to look at some obvious clues to find the real murderer. If he is eventually released with a pardon, Downing will be the longest serving wrongly convicted prisoner in history and could eventually receive over £1 million in compensation.
Stephen Downing grew up inside prison, or rather inside various prisons. His career as an inmate saw him housed in jails all around the UK, and campaigners for his release fervently believe that Stephen, like Wendy, was an innocent victim of the crime. So it's now Wednesday. I'm back in Wales to talk to Don Hale again. I'm just sitting on the beach before I go to his house. It's a very lovely, kind of grey, still day. Just kind of getting my thoughts in order, really. So, Stephen has refused to speak to us. He was quite rude to me on the phone, I think it's fair to say. I think he's had a bad experience with journalists and was sort of lumping me in the same category as them, as kind of blood-sucking leeches. Not quite direct quote, but pretty much. Yeah, not totally pleasant, but not, you know, understandable because, you know, the guy spent years in jail. Okay, so let's talk about Stephen. So since our last meeting, I had quite a difficult conversation with Stephen, and he said he doesn't want to be part of this. Doesn't want to contribute to this.
No.
this series.
I didn't think he would, to be honest. No, I think what people have to realise is that, you know, although he's what now 62, he's been through hell and back, really, over his time. You know, he was jailed when he was 17, convicted as a murderer, and spent best part 28 years in prison. And when he came out, the world had moved on so quickly that he found it very difficult to cope with everything. You know, we didn't have things like mobile phones, McDonald's, a whole range of things that we take for granted now. And he did find it very, very difficult to settle down. And he got some sort of education within prison. He knuckled down and took various exams and sort of qualified for a chef and different things. So he made something of the best of his life, if you can, in prison. But he thought he would spend the rest of his life in prison as a lifer. According to the Home Office information when I was dealing with it, he would have been 70 before he was released. So all this plays a massive part emotionally. I mean, I found it very difficult, obviously, in rethinking everything for this book and the podcast, everything else, to throw your mind back. I mean, I'm going back 25 years when I first started on this case, and it's brought back a lot of emotions for me. When I first started on this, I found it very difficult to sleep because you're bringing back emotions that you've tried to put away, tried to forget the worst of it. It is worrying, and I think Stephen's gone through the same sort of thing. When this has been put back to him, lots of things have flooded back into his mind and things he wanted to forget literally forever. And his life has been absolutely trash because of this case. And so I can understand that he doesn't want to take part.
I was going to talk to Stephen to get him to give a picture of himself in his own words. Mm. But in the absence of that, I'm going to ask you about it. But also, you had an extensive correspondence with him and visiting him in prison.
Yeah.
And so on. So tell me about Stephen.
Obviously, I first came across Stephen in 1994 when I started on the campaign. I went to the parents' house a couple of days after they first visited me at the Mantle & Mercury offices. The arrangement was Stephen would phone from prison within a period of an hour that I was there or so, and he did. And that was my first contact with him.
A phone call from prison? Which prison was this?
This was in Dorchester prison. You're only allowed a couple of minutes on these things. You got a phone card or something, and everything's monitored. It was a fairly brief conversation, but he was very pleased that I was taking an interest in the case. Sounded quite nervous, quite emotional in a sense with that.
Did he sound like you expected him to sound? Did he come across how you expected him?
He sounded almost a bit mousy, really, a bit sort of quiet and almost apologetic. You know, sorry to have put you to this trouble type thing. He wasn't a confident person at all. And he almost probably thinking, well, you're just another journalist, really, as I think the parents probably thought initially. You're going to run a story or two and that will be it. You know, thanks, but no thanks. We're just reviving the general pattern of what's happened with the case. But that wasn't my intention, really. It was to sort of say, right, I mean, I was new. I was an outsider. You know, I'd come from sort of Manchester area. So this was new to me. I hadn't known anything about the case at all. And I think that was good because I was starting from the lowest level and working my way up. That started correspondence with him for about 8 years, you know.
Dear Don, I was pleased to read of your progress you are making. I don't want to dash anyone's hope of success, but I can't help feeling that the whole thing will be a wet squib. With all this now coming on top of me, I can't help wondering if I will ever get out. I'm sorry for being so depressed. Best regards, Stephen Downing.
So where did you go and visit him?
Well, the first one I went to was at Dorchester. Horrendous journey for me from Derbyshire, travelling down there. It was in winter. I was used to the prison system, yes. If you like. I knew what to expect in many ways. But I went in there. You go into the waiting room. You have to have your VO stamped.
That's a visiting order.
A visiting order. And your details are checked, basically, on that. They're verified that you are allowed to visit that person on that day, etc., etc. I was kept waiting for ages and I was the only one that was detained. Everyone else went in. And after a while, the lady was sort of cleaning up and said, look, love, you better go up to the gate and they've obviously forgotten about you. Well, it was obviously deliberate. They didn't want me going in. And they were telling me, oh, he's changed his mind. He doesn't want to see you. And I said, well, I've come all this way. I'd like to have a face-to-face. So if he tells me that face-to-face, that's fine. But he's written to me. We've had correspondence and all the rest. And I knocked on the door and it was like the old... almost like Nottingham Castle type thing where you've got a small door within a massive door and this guy opens up the thing and he's spitting food at me as he's, well, what do you want? All this sort of thing. And I'm so, gave him a name I said, I've got visitors. Oh, you're too late. You know, it's already gone. He's trying to shut the door. And I'm saying, whoa, hang on a minute. And so eventually I'm allowed into this old small courtyard, and he's still eating his pie and his food and stuff like that, spitting all over you, you know. And eventually, I make a bit of a fuss, and they call the supervisor, and they say, okay, we're allowed to, as long as you agree to a strip search, you know. Well, I've never had a strip search in my life, really, no need for it. But I had to agree to that before they would even consider coming through. And so, you strip down socks and shoes, strip down to your underpants, basically, you know. You check your clothing, make sure you're not carrying anything in, knives or blades or anything like that, you know. Anyways, I'm putting it back on, you know. I accidentally knocked off the warder's meat pie onto the floor and then deliberately stood on it, you know, so that, I'm sorry about that, mate, you know, just to sort of get my own back on him, really. And eventually I'm allowed through gates after gates after gates, and I'm about half an hoor behind everybody else because of all this hoo-ha, you know. And eventually I get through to see Stephen, and he's sort of, you know, comes through the gates there, grinning at me, you know, almost delighted to have a visitor, you know, because he didn't get many. Very, very rare, few and far between. So we sort of shook hands and whatever, and we put a table. They prepared a special table for us, and you're surrounded by, I don't know, four warders or something like that. So they're listening to every word. You're not allowed to obviously touch him or hug him or anything like that, you know. And we just had a sort of a general chit chat to start with before we got onto any sort of serious questions. Then, because I've been travelling for a long while, I'd not really had anything much to eat or drink for 2 days, you see. And so it was all rush, rush, rush to do it. And I wanted to be on time and go through all this. So this normally have the WRVS trolley that comes round, usually an old lady or something pushing it round, and they've got a little reception desk as well there. Anyway, this big guy comes round, you know, saying sandwiches, drinks, anybody want anything? So I'm sort of, yeah, okay, I'll, and Stephen's sort of kicking me under the table and sort of, no, you know. So I said, no, it's okay, I'll leave it for the moment. I said, well, what's wrong, Stephen? He says, oh, that's Fred or whatever he's called, you know, he's in for poisoning, you know. And it just seems, you know, black humour in a sense of a prison that the man doing the tea trolley and all the sandwiches is in for poisoning.
Because of his youth and his lack of worldly experience, Stephen told Don that he'd found adjusting to life inside hard.
Yeah, he'd been in a lot of very high-profile prisons where you mix him with, you know, paedophiles, murderers, rapists, all sorts of individuals, really. And you're sharing cells with these people, you're sharing your table with them, you know, very heavy people. You know, I think he met, or not met, but saw Ian Brady in one of his prisons he was in.
Ian Brady, the Moore's murderer?
Moore's murderer, yes. And he's come across a lot of, you know, serial killers and different people in the past. You know, bearing in mind his mental state at the time, and, you know, you've got to just get on with it, really.
Was he classed as a sex offender because of the sexual assault elements of the conviction?
That's right, yeah. And that's part of this in denial, because you're classed, if you're in denial, particularly of a murder, but any serious offence, really, people think you're more dangerous because you refuse to accept it. He should have attended sex offenders courses for rehabilitation, and he refused to go on that throughout his prison life. Yeah, throughout 26, 27 years, he refused to go on these because there was no point. It's like the Alcoholics Anonymous or any others, where you're in a circle and you're all admitting that you've got certain problems or whatever. But if you've not done it, how can you admit or join in with this? Again, it impacted on any chance or any hope of parole. So it was a never-never land, really. Unless you admit that you've committed a murder or sex offence, you're never going to get out. And it was an impossible position. And that's one of the reasons I took it up with the European courts, you know, because he wouldn't even allow, because of that, to have an interview before the parole board to put his case.
How was he treated? And because, I mean, I know sort of anecdotally people talk about kind of being a sexual offender can make you the target within the prison system.
Yeah.
What was his experiences that he related to you?
I mean, I put quite as much as he can in the book about this, but I mean, he went through a horrendous time, particularly when he first started his sort of prison sentence, because obviously it's fairly fresh then. Everybody in prison gets to know about it, if, you know, when it's published in papers and radio, television, whatever. And so it becomes like a nonce, really. He's accused of being a sex offender. Quite often you sort of, you know, stripped naked and thrown in showers where it's absolutely piping hot. You know, it's the lobster treatment, they call it, you know, where you just turn, you deliberately kept in hot water and you turn into a lobster. You're more or less scolded, really. You're beaten up. Showers are very, very slippery, you know. They put soap on the floor, so you're dancing and you're falling over, and sometimes they put a fire hose on you, you know, which the prison authorities turn a blind eye to.
I was going to say, what do the warders do?
Yeah, they just stand by because they hate sex offenders in particular. So he's gone through all that. He's been abused himself. He's been attacked several times. You know, his life's been pretty hell, particularly, say, in the early years.
Did he talk to you about this in person or in letters or on?
No, mainly in person, really. And again, it was something he wanted to sort of say, you know, let's forget it, let's move on. Mm. I've not gone into great detail with all this in the book because he didn't want me to. Yeah, if he wants to talk about it sometimes later, well, that's fine. But, you know, I can understand and appreciate what's happened to him. It has been pretty horrific.
Is this one of them here?
Yeah, that's right. This is a response to a Home Office document.
Right, so I've got one of the letters that Stephen... Is this the original?
Yeah, he's typed these.
So this is the one of the letters that... Of responses to...
Well, basically what's happened, I put in an initial submission to the police and the Home Office based on my original findings over maybe the first 6 months. Which were fairly lightweight, but it's to test the water, to see what they wanted to do and what they had. Because, you know, you've got the police saying everything's been burnt, lost and destroyed. You've got the Home Office saying we don't know where he is, basically. He's lost in the system. So I wanted to push the boat out and say, right, will you tell me where he is in the system? What documents have you got? So I put in this first submission with limited evidence to say that there was doubt against the conviction. And they would respond. And the Home Office Minister would respond. I think it was Tim Kirkhope initially in that, from the service. And so I would then pass that to Stephen and say, right, what is your response to that? And so he would write this.
So these are the point-by-point response of Stephen's to... So you put it in a submission of points you want to make to the Home Office. They answered back with questions or rebuttals.
They'd reject it and say, points. This is the reason why we're not interested.
And this is Stephen taking up their point. Yeah. So it's going... Yeah. So page 2, paragraph 5. So he's responded bits.
He's gone through the whole thing, and particular emphasis where he's putting his side and contradicting what the government paper, the Home Office, are saying.
Yeah. So for instance, here it says page 2, paragraph 5. And Steve has written, I don't know why he is questioning the validity of whether or not I had a spinal condition, which I'm sure is well documented in medical records. The same would apply with my having gone back to work that very day after having had time off with a cold.
Mm.
So just
point by point.
Yeah, point by point. Yeah. Yes, very.
Because
very,
what I was finding is
very detailed.
The Home Office, and so they sent very sketchy replies, which you could absolutely rip to shreds. They were full of anomalies, riddled with errors, et cetera, which needed to be rectified first of all, because you think, well, if that is the basis of their defence, if you like, in terms of trying to say, you know, he must be guilty, it's pretty ropey.
Mm, yeah.
So with Stephen able to do that, and address it point by point was a great help to me, because I couldn't have done that myself without him giving me that information.
And
I couldn't contradict it.
Through your relationship, you gave him kind of confidence and the tools to be actively known this.
That's right, yeah.
Can we look at some letters?
We put quite a few letters in the book about my relationship with Stephen. I mean, the first one was December 1994, so that was, about three or four months after I started on the case.
December 1994, Her Majesty's Prison, 7 North Square, Dorchester, Dorset. Dear Don, I would like to thank you and all your staff for taking interest in my case, but above all, for believing in my innocence. I appreciate that this is quite an undertaking for a small paper to take on. I hope that I'm able to help you with your investigation as much as I possibly can. I trust what I've sent you will be enough to get you started. Please feel free to ask me more. I don't see why I should sit back and let you do all the work. Best regards, Stephen Downing.
That was his very first one.
So that's nice. So he's recognising the effort and
yeah.
And want to be involved. The next one, the February one, talking about putting the yeah. story in the Mercury.
Well, that's right. I mean, following on from the first story in the Mercury.
5th of February, 1995. Dear Don, it really is amazing the power the press has on people. I would never have thought for a minute that one of the four suspects would have come forward to tender evidence, perhaps even against his own friends. I find it equally hard to believe that the police have allowed vital evidence to remain in a vault for almost 22 years. It seems they were desperate to secure a conviction and a fast one, with little regard for who should have shouldered the blame. It has often been said the truth will always prevail, and now it looks as if I'm on that path. That proves yet again the old adage is true. It wasn't until the Daily Star took up my plight in a bid to establish my innocence that I began to have reservations about the kind of reception I would get from fellow inmates. Any fears I had can certainly be laid to rest. This has become big news, and the buzz of excitement ripples through the wing at Mail Corps, with a number of eager lags jolting to be next to me in line and read the following instalments in what has become Dorchester Prison's very own soap opera. Even the staff are wishing me well to fight to have the Home Secretary exercise a royal prerogative of mercy. The wealth of evidence contained in a dossier would appear to offer the Home Secretary little choice in what action he can take. Whether or not Mr. Howard will view it as a case of Hobson's choice remains to be seen. Stephen Downing.
Well, they could say that he's actually served over his time. Not saying he's innocent,
yeah.
But he's served over his time, he's over his tariff, and that they consider him safe to be released. So, but the Queen would have had to endorse that. He was being detained at Her Majesty's pleasure. Michael Howard was involved then as the Home Secretary. It says the wealth of evidence contained in the dossier would appear to offer the Home Secretary little choice in what action he can take. Whether or not Mr. Howard will view this as a case of Hobson's choice remains to be seen. So he's a bit naive in a sense, thinking, well, because we've got a big splash in the newspapers and the Daily Star and other nationals are beginning to sort of take a shine to this, and I put the submission in, that it's going to be a piece of cake.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
William Tyrrell was a three-year-old boy who disappeared from the township of Kendal on the New South Wales mid-north coast on 12 September 2014. Police have been told he was outside playing one minute and gone the next. His disappearance has become one of the most puzzling investigations in Australian history. It has been going on now for almost 5 years. Millions of dollars have been spent. The strike force at one point had 26 full-time detectives. Hundreds more around Australia have been exploring 600 possible suspects. And what has all that been for? William is still missing. My name is Caroline Overington. This investigation, Nowhere Child, is available now. To hear more, just search for Nowhere Child in your podcast app.
Stephen had turned down my request to talk to him, so I sat down with Don Hale in his cottage in Wales to learn about the man he'd spent 8 years attempting to free.
What was the feeling you got from people in Bakewell about Stephen?
Well, generally, I mean, people say, you know, after all these, we're not worried and that. Well, yes, there's always the nutters out there.
Yes.
You don't know who they are. And if, as I'm campaigning for Stephen, if you're saying he didn't do it, then obviously somebody else did do it. And there's that worry that that person could be still out there, or their associates or whatever could be working for them to make sure you and other witnesses don't say what you intend to say. So you've got that. But generally, I made myself known in Bakewell as much as he could. We had a few public meetings and things. We had a public demonstration, and absolutely thousands of people would turn up for these things. And people would be patting on the back in the street and shaking your hand and say, well, thank God somebody's doing something about it at last, you know. He's serving time for somebody else. We all know who's done it, don't we, and all this sort of thing.
The years go by, the case drags on, and Stephen is still in prison.
There were several months, anyway, that we went when I didn't know where he was, and his family didn't know where he was for certain. See, the more I'm pressing and pushing to do it, because I won't back down, he won't back down. He's then moved from a very sort of fairly laid back sort of place at Dorchester. He's put in Dartmoor, which is probably one of the toughest prisons in the country, in a sense. It's a very old Napoleonic prison. It used to be there for, you know, the prisoners from Napoleon all those years ago, and it's not changed a great deal in some parts. So he's put in like the older part. And on his own admission, he's put in with all the other troublemakers on a wing that's deliberately sort of created. You know, windows missing, it's freezing cold. He's sent there in the middle of winter. He's sent there in... I mean, I didn't know. He disappeared off the radar.
Her Majesty's Prison, Dartmoor, Yeovilston, Devon. Dear Don, I thought you'd like to hear a few words from me. I've gone down with a cold again. The cell is quite spacious, though sparsely furnished. There's no light switch on the inside, so lights are turned off at 11 p.m. I have to wedge close one of the windows, but even that doesn't ward off the bitter cold. I'm typing this with my denim jacket on. It's just as well this donkey jacket is part of the clothing issue, as I might have to start wearing that too. All outgoing letters are censored and phone calls are monitored. The regime here is very much different from the other places I've been to. Best wishes, Stephen Downing.
So he's really under pressure, you know, to, and he's told, get rid of this guy, get him off your back, you know. If you want to enjoy any sort of lifestyle here, you know, you've got to admit you've done it, admit you're going to take part in these sex offenders courses and get rid of this journalist, you know.
So he was told very directly that he would be moved to this draconic prison because of your interference.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And I complained to, I think it was Jack Straw then, as the Home Secretary for it, because I'd only just been in contact with him about all this. And within weeks of that, he's suddenly moved in the middle of the night to Dartmoor, where you can see it's absolutely freezing cold, no heating, lighting, whatever. And you're putting on every ounce of clothing to try and keep warm. So, I mean, I've said, you know, down his correspondence and chats with his family, a few phone calls that was home, wasn't allowed to contact me at all, totally banned from that. You're blocked. You're only allowed one call to a certain number, which is the home number. He was still clinging to the hope of another transfer out, and what he was trying to get was to somewhere with more sort of educational facilities. As much as I appreciate all that everyone is trying to do for me, the mere mention of any other establishment is likely to have the allocations unit considering it as a possibility. I've already had to write, pleading with them to send me to Little Hay rather than anywhere else.
That's Little Hay?
That's sort of Nottingham.
Oh, right, so yeah. much nearer than Dartmoor.
It's true that I would be closer to home if it was at Nottingham, but this is Category B prison and would be a step backwards for me in terms of progression through the system.
And Little Hay's an open
prison?
I think
it's C. I think it's C1, yeah. No, not open, no. It's still quite strict there. Yeah. I've been there lots of times. The reason I feel so strongly about Little Hay is that they offer an education 7 days a week, and part of the curriculum includes law and chemistry, which I'd like to study.
Interesting.
I know of no other prison which offers those. At the end of each day, I'm the one stuck behind bars, so I want my incarceration to be as comfortable as possible. Now, he's still in there. This is in October. He's still in there in late November when he's getting down and depressed again, really, you know.
Her Majesty's Prison, Dartmoor, Yelverton, Devon, 2nd of November 1996. This will be my fifth Christmas without a visit from my family. It's supposed to be a prison policy to promote family ties. If it wasn't for my family, I will withdraw any attempts of an appeal and say, you've kept me this long, you can keep me for the rest of my life. Best wishes, Stephen Downing.
September 97. He's put now handwritten. Because he's sending me now a handwritten letter, but all the others have been typewritten. Don, I had to hand in my typewriter after being told I'm not allowed it, after no less than 5 years. I believe it all began when John Atkins, my lawyer, asked if he might be permitted to see me again in the afternoon. He was told no. Unknown to me, he telephoned the prison after leaving and was told by the life of governor that he could not see me. I'm sure it's one of the wing SOs who refused and was niggled at getting his decision overruled. Next, I was told I could no longer have letter-headed paper.
September the 2nd, 1997. Now handwritten. Dear Don, I was deeply sorry to learn of the death of Princess Diana. At least she is at peace and not harassed by the press. I do hope there will be news of major development soon, particularly to say there will be an appeal. I would also like bail to be granted, as I want to be with my family. Best wishes, Stephen Downing.
Got another one from 97.
Yeah. This is following my appearance really before the parole board, when I say I was rejected, more or less out of hand. It was an absolute waste of time going, really. But this is November 97. Don, I should be grateful if you'd approach the Secretary of State on my behalf following the outcome of my recent HMP tribunal. As you know, the parole board turned me down for release in licence and considered me unsuitable for transfer to open conditions for the same reason, because he's in denial, you see. The main reason is their assumption that I need to address my offending behaviour and prove that I do not present a risk to the public. The doctor made it quite clear that I was not a risk to the public and said I had cooperated and shown that I was not in need of a SOTB, a sex offenders course, and as I showed no signs of any sexual deviance. So it's the same old problem coming back time after time, you see. So you never get in it. But he's not allowed to present his case still. It's me or John that's doing it.
Did it attract the attention of, I don't know what you call them? Often, you know, prisoners can attract attention from particularly women or a sexual attention from people who want to write and kind of fetishise.
He started to get quite a mailbox of admirers and things like that, where, you know, obviously women. I mean, I've been a prison visitor before this for years, and I was always amazed at the number of quite often attractive women, etc., that would write to prisoners, particularly lifers, and form a bond and association, and sometimes, you know, married them. I've been to two weddings as a witness for murderers, lifers. In prison, in Nottingham.
But at the time of the attack and of Stephen's arrest, trial and conviction, there was much talk from some of the police involved and in the town itself of Stephen having a bit of a reputation and for being a pervert. Many people seemed a bit unsurprised when Stephen was arrested and, initially at least, confessed to the attack and to the sexual motive.
Once I got involved with the investigation, so many people said that they'd been down to the police station and they'd seen Ernie, and he said, you're basically wasting your time, he's already admitted it. We've got the man that's done it, that's it. And he was the man that was seen to be continually saying that, making false allegations about Stephen.
Charlesworth,
yeah. Yeah. That, you know, oh, yeah, we've been watching him for years. He'd been up to different things. There was an assault on a woman, you know, a few years before when I think he's probably about 14 or something like that. You know, there was all sorts of things that didn't stand up, really. But it was the impression he was giving to fellow officers and the impression given to Joe Public that Stephen had got... was a bit of an oddball and a bit, you know, potentially a pervert.
Don believes one of the main sources of these rumours about Stephen harassing women came from one policeman in particular, Ernie Charlesworth.
We talked about outsiderness and that, you know, Stephen was sort of marked out as being a bit outside.
Well, he was a loner. He was a bit of an odd child. He'd not got many friends. He got learning difficulties, should I say, really. He was classed as, the official title was Backward, where he got a reading age of 11, and he kept himself to himself, really. He liked his music, and he liked his own company, shall we say.
It stands out against the background of being a teenage boy in Wakewell at that time.
That's right. I mean, you know, there were lots of organisations he could have joined, but he didn't really want to do it. He wasn't particularly sporty. He wasn't outgoing. He's quite a shy nature, and so, you know, why should he join these clubs, really? But if you didn't join, then you were classed as being a bit simple or a bit, you know, a bit odd in terms of, you know, well, he won't join him. You know, there's something odd about him. And he was a quietish lad who just wanted to be in his, you know, do his own thing, really. He liked nature. He was very good with his hands. He's quite good at sort of engineering type things, putting things together. And he got an interest in cooking, you know, catering. He did meals and things for his parents and things like that. And he always, you know, maintained that sort of interest. But because you weren't joining in with a gang and you were a bit shy and reticent of other boys and that, you were classed as an odd boy, you see. And it's something that happens quite often.
As you said, you know, if after 10, 20 years of coming from Manchester, you can still be the foreigner.
I had abuse and things all the time and that thing. You know, what do you know? You've only been here 10 years and all this sort of thing, you know. Well, how many years do you have to be somewhere before you actually accept it? I don't know, but you know, I just took it in my stride, really. Mm. You know, I mean, people have tried to bully me at school and different things, and I've stood up to them.
I wondered whether your determination, and particularly the way you kind of write about standing up to like Charlesworth and other people basically trying to bully you, and seeing Stephen, that otherness, rang bells for you, whether that's part of your motivation.
Well, yeah, I mean, I had...
Fighting bullies.
You know, as the case sort of progressed, my investigations progressed, I ended up with sympathy for Stephen in the way he had been bullied in his life, and the way, because he was slightly different, that he was... you know, people threw these allegations at him, and he wasn't the sort that would challenge them. You see, he wouldn't go and, you know, play pot with Ernie Charles or anyone, and very few others would. I mean, he was a bully. I'd met him, I'd known him before, I'd come across him before, and he was very arrogant sort of guy. He wouldn't give you time of day. He hated journalists. I don't think he liked me at all before this case even started, really. But the fact that I was editor of the local paper and I was asking questions that he didn't like, not just about this, but other cases in the past, he just wasn't prepared to talk to me. And he was very, very aggressive with me. And many times I thought he was going to attack me over things. You know, and he was a very difficult guy to deal with. But when all this sort of came to light and his name kept coming up, I would go back to him and ask him about what he knew. And, you know, I went round to his house one time and... Well, he's making allegations of that, and I particularly wanted to find out why he was saying these things about Stephen still and things. So I wanted to know, has he ever been charged with any offence?
Had Stephen been
Has he ever been in trouble with anything? And, you know, obviously he refused to deal with anything. I mean, I don't lose my temper very often, to be perfectly honest, but I got a dislike of this guy because he was a liar and a cheat. There's no two ways about it. After reading a lot of the stuff, I knew that he could have helped Stephen rather than hindered him. And he was the Mr. Nice Guy seemingly in the interrogation. you know, just tell me, you know, like the kind uncle, just tell me what was what, and we can sort things out. It'd be much easier for you.
Good cop, bad cop, approach of interrogation, so we're familiar with from TV.
Yeah, I mean, the two tough guy detectives would come in two at a time. They'd do the bit and then leave Ernie to sort it out. You know, oh, don't worry about them. Don't worry about them. Look, it's all right. Everything will be all right. You know, you want to go home, don't you? You want to have a rest. And, you know, I'm making it sound nice and cosy. Just tell us what, you know, what really happened then. And, you know, everything could be all right. And he was the guy that was supposed, you know, Stephen's supposed to confess to, say, all right, I'll tell you then what happened. He dashes out and brings the senior officers back, etc. So he got a lot to answer for, and a lot of questions I wanted to put to him. I said, where have you got this information from? I said, it's all rubbish. I said, I can give you the information that you need. You know, because you charged, you spoke to the person that was responsible for an attack on a woman that you still blame Stephen for, you know, after 20 years or 20, whatever years, 25 years, I think it was. He still blamed Stephen, was telling Stephen he was responsible for an attack on a woman in Bakewell, smacking someone's bottom, running through the park or whatever. And it had been proven that it wasn't him, because he was at school at a presentation night and his picture actually appeared in the paper that next week.
So this was the prior form, the prior perverted behaviour that he was implying.
But for years and years later, he still said that he believed Stephen was the man responsible. But that's typical of the way he was. And he was still the local bully, and everybody knew him as the local bully, and people were frightened of him, you know. Well, I say he didn't frighten me, but I think it would have come to fisticuffs if it came within a whisker of that.
Unsurprisingly, the police don't agree with Don's view of Charlesworth. But for me, the difference in opinion raised questions over if he was a bad cop, as Don believes, or simply a local bobby in a small rural town dealing with an incredibly violent crime and out of his depth. This was Bakewell, not the Bronx.
I was 17 when my mum died. My middle sister was 15 and my baby sister was 10.
Susan Mills, who lived in the town and knew Wendy before the attack, experienced a different side of Ernie.
When my dad went, I was 18. My middle sister was 16 and my baby sister was 11, and we were left just left and the policeman knew all the kids, and you know.
And who's the policeman?
Well, the main one was Ernie Charlesworth at that time.
What's he like?
He was all right, because after my dad left, I was at work and my sisters were at school, and it was about 6 months after my dad had gone, and I came home from work. I'd nipped home at lunchtime and somebody had been in the house, and I couldn't think who it'd be other than my father had come in and he'd taken some stuff, and this was about 6 months after he'd gone. And so I went to see Ernie Charlesworth, and I said to Ernie, I'm a bit frightened now because I don't want my dad coming back in the night or anything like that. So Ernie came and he helped me change the locks on all the house, on the doors. And he helped me do that.
And was he all right? Cause
he was all right.
He comes across, I think... you know, when I read Don's book, and, you know, Don's obviously had some run-ins with him. And
well,
there's no love lost in that front.
Ernie would have been on the defensive with him because he was accusing him. I mean, Stephen, back in the 70s, and you have to remember as well, nothing had ever happened like this in Bakewell before. Nothing. So little local bobbies in Bakewell Police Station wouldn't have a clue how to handle somebody who just, let alone a young teenager who'd murdered somebody, they just wouldn't know how to handle it. And I am sure that they did everything wrong. They didn't have a responsible adult with him. They didn't follow the protocol. But they would never have hurt him or manhandled him or anything like that. They probably didn't follow the what, because I don't think they know what to do, to be honest.
Eventually, Stephen's legal team win victory to overturn the restrictions on prisoners who are, in denial, being allowed to petition for parole.
So when did you get victory on the in denial thing? When was it taken off the British statute?
It all came in sort of in the late 90s, really. I can't remember exact dates now without looking at all the notes, but it went on sort of, you know, 96 to sort of 99-ish, that sort of region. I mean, eventually, you know, the government admitted defeat and they paid him €500 as compensation.
They paid Stephen €500.
Yeah,
Euros.
Yeah.
And how many years had you been inside at this point?
22, 23 maybe.
I'm not going to do the maths on that, 500 divided by.
But, I mean, they were quite incensed. They still didn't want to do this, but they were sort of commanded by the European Court, and this was eventually, well, it was adopted into European rules fairly quickly, and so eventually into British law.
Though teeth grindingly slow, the case was progressing, but now it was measured out in years rather than in the months that Don had originally hoped. It was far, far from the neat 90-minute story arc of a TV crime show.
Did it feel close to 95?
Well, it was a bit of a phony war in a way. It was, I thought, I mean, I was naive as well. This is my first sort of big case, if you like, with this sort of information. But I thought, well, okay, if you provide enough information to counter sort of the intelligence that's put out by the Home Office, that you're casting doubt over the conviction, in effect, that I would certainly get an appointment with the C3, go through it with them in some office in London, and possibly get an appeal within 12 months, 2 years sort of thing, you know, with the backing of legals and whatever. But it became pretty obvious that this wasn't the way they worked, you know. And again, it was going through this sort of transition period with the
It's obviously got the Blair regime comes in.
Yeah, that's right. And also there was a sort of becoming a sort of a review of the prison system and things. And we're all, say, fairly naive, if you like, in those days in terms of thinking, well, this is not going to go on for that long.
It'll be over by Christmas instead of World War I.
That's right, yeah. it was a strange one because I was in completely unknown territory, not knowing how long these things would take, how the system works or what was what.
It seems to be that there was this kind of peak of Don's investigation, and then obviously he's got a paper that to print things on, a lot of attention, and then it's kind of like, yeah. And it all goes quiet for like 5 years. Yeah.
Well, no, I think that was one of the frustrating things.
Patrick McLaughlin is the Member of Parliament for the region which includes Bakewell.
It was one of the frustrating things. So if you go back to, I think the Home Office were in the case of sort of saying we're going to set up this independent commission, and therefore they were sort of holding things back while it went to the independent commission. Then it went to the independent commission, and there we go.
Right, so it was also caught between kind of system changes.
Yes.
Ah, that makes sense. Yes. Frustrating.
But I'm not sure that was added. That may have added sort of 12 months or so. Mm-hmm. It still doesn't explain the 27 years.
Now, finally, after Stephen's legal team won the right for prisoners in denial to petition for parole, Stephen could finally have his day in court and his right to appeal. Having maintained his innocence of the murder of Wendy Saul for 27 years, could he be about to walk free?
Did Stephen always retain positivity, or did he ever have moments of just thought, like, this is too much, just jack it all in? And
it was ups and downs, really. I mean, my campaign was pretty heavy going for everybody concerned, because, you know, it's three steps forward and two steps back all the time. There were continual knockbacks in terms of, you know, the Home Office not wanting to deal with it. They didn't even know where he was. Got him down as the Vern, and he'd moved from there, I don't know, 2 or 3 years before, I think it was. He was now in Dorchester. They didn't really bother. And their attitude on the phone to me was, well, you know, he's in IDOM, you know. He's like scum. You know, we're not bothered about it. Nobody cares about him.
Nidum is in denial of murder.
That's right. And I'm sort of saying, well, you know, I care about it. He's still got his family. They are campaigning for it. They've been campaigning for much longer than I have, 20 years before. You know, there could well be new evidence that comes to light that could doubt it. And they were very much doubting Thomas's. They weren't interested. Look, he's, you know, he's a low life. We're not really interested. He's bottom of the pile. And I had to keep saying to them, you know, and they said, well, why do you keep saying he's in Dorchester? And I said, well, because I've been to visit him. I went to see him last week, you know. I was thinking, well, if they don't know about him, how many other people have been lost in the system? They didn't care. And it seemed to be their attitude that if you're in denial of any offence, not necessarily murder, but in denial of any offence, you're on the blacklist. And it's the forgotten list, if you like. We don't give a damn about them because they're not going to get out.
Another side to the story.
Who's slagging me off then?
Next time.
But it's still an unsolved murder. It's still worthy of investigation.
Reporter, Murder in the Graveyard was presented and produced by me, Lucy Ditchmont. Liam Burns was reading the letters of Stephen Downing. It was mixed by Dave Dodd. The music was composed and performed by Edwin Pearson. The executive producer was Matt Hall. Reporter, Murder in the Graveyard was a Wireless Studios production. And you can listen to Reporter, Murder in the Graveyard on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts from. And please feel free to rate and review.
A brutal murder, a wrongful conviction, a 27-year fight for justice. Read the full story that inspired this podcast. In Murder in the Graveyard, investigative journalist Don Hale tells the story of his relentless fight to overturn the longest miscarriage of justice the UK has ever seen. Delve deeper into the case that shocked the nation. Murder in the Graveyard. Available now in paperback, ebook, and audio narrated by author Don Hale himself.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.